I'd like to invite you to tonight's program, Beyond the Beer, Rediscovering Irish-American Culture and Heritage. The event is sponsored by the World Affairs Council Young Professionals International Forum and is co-sponsored also by UC Berkeley's Celtic Studies program. My name is Heather White. I am one of the program coordinators for tonight's event. For those who may be new to this organization, the World Affairs Council was established in 1947 to engage the public in exploration of issues and opportunities that transcend borders. To learn more about the organization and its diverse series of programs, please visit our website at www.itsyourworld.org. The Young Professionals International Forum, known as the IF, is a volunteer subcommittee of the World Affairs Council founded to promote the involvement of younger council members. The IF creates public programs as well as organizes social and cultural events that provide an environment for younger people of international interests to meet and share experiences. Before we begin, please take a moment to turn off your cell phones. While you do that, let me take this opportunity to announce a few upcoming IF events. So next month, on Tuesday, April 6th, please join the IF for our monthly steering committee meeting, where we will explore international current affairs through informal discussion groups and plan council events like the one that you're attending tonight. We encourage you to join us for this meeting, which will be held here at the World Affairs Council on the second floor at 6:30 p.m. Then the following week, on Monday, April 12th, join the IF for a Global Town Hall monthly discussion group series. The discussion group is designed to allow IF and council members to exchange opinions in a friendly, conversational forum while hearing a diversity of perspectives on complex global issues. All right, so before introducing our speakers, I'd just like to, to point out that following the remarks, we'll have time for 10 to 15 minutes of questions. So if you do have a question, please use the microphone in the front of the room. Following the question and answer period, we'll begin our reception of food and drinks, courtesy of Breda Courtney of Wild Irish Productions. We have all sorts of homemade goodies we're all very excited about. If you have any additional questions, you can pose them to our speakers during the reception. It's now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guests. So our first speaker, Daniel Melia, is professor in the Department of Rhetoric and Celtic Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. Dr. Melia joins us tonight to discuss Irish culture and heritage and the legacy it left behind in the United States. Then our second speaker will be Sean O'Nulon. Dr. O'Nulon has taught and researched at both UC Berkeley and Stanford. He's written numerous academic papers in addition to several books. Together with Melanie O'Reilly, Dr. O'Nulon teaches a course and workshop on Irish music. Then we have Melanie O'Reilly, an international known Celtic jazz performer, singer, songwriter, and music educator. She's from Ireland. Her research on 19th century Irish women immigrants who traveled to the United States brought her to UC Berkeley's Celtic Studies program, where she was a visiting research scholar and musician in residence from 2003 to 2008. And she's very busy this St. Patrick's Day, so we're really lucky to have her tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming our speakers.
Mess up any of the electronics here. Can you hear me okay? Yeah. I can yell anyway if you can't. If you have any questions, just write them on your palms and then you can remember them later. I'm going to talk about a little bit about St. Patrick in a minute, but the rather thin and stereotypical notions about Irish culture surviving in American pop culture are partially the result of the successful assimilation of earlier Irish immigrants into the mainstream. My grandparents could remember No Irish Need Apply signs in Boston, but few people in the present day could even tell you that such signs once existed. The downside of this phenomenon, however, is the substitution of one or two alleged Irish cultural markers, usually drunkenness and sentimentality and an affection for the color green, for any real knowledge of the home culture, even amongst many second and third generation Americans of Irish descent. For the stereotypes, have a look at the general run of St. Patrick's Day cards, drunken leprechauns with Kiss Me, I'm Irish buttons and the like, or the opening scenes of the Tom Cruise epic Far and Away, which show a drunken father getting himself fatally run down by the English landowner's carriage, followed by a scene of totally unprovoked but whiskey-fueled fisticuffs amongst his three strapping sons. Some popular beliefs which I can correct for you. One, like Santa Claus, there is only one leprechaun. Two, in spite of the views of Walt Disney and Darby O'Gill, the little people are not little. They're the same size we are, nor are they traditionally called little people in Ireland. because they're not. They're not little, and they're not people. The shamrock is not a three or four-leaf clover and is, in fact, unrelated to those North American species. And thus, St. Patrick did not use a clover to explain the idea of the Trinity to the High King of Ireland. And, by the way, the very term High King could not have existed until at least 5 centuries after Patrick's life. Now I've found that I'm out of... there we go. After Patrick's lifetime. Six, alas, St. Patrick did not drive the snakes out of Ireland either, as there were never any there to be driven out. Seven, Patrick was certainly not the first Christian missionary in Ireland. And eight, he wasn't even Irish. He was British and, by his own account, a proud citizen of the Roman Empire. This is all tough to take, but it's all true. In the hope of spreading better information in popular culture, I'm here to offer some new information about the actual St. Patrick, who was a real person, a real missionary, and an extraordinary man, though perhaps not an easy guy to deal with. I often start my courses involving medieval Ireland by taking a survey of the students, asking them when, plus or minus 100 years, St. Patrick lived. Don't worry, I'm not going to do that here. Guesses over the last 2 or 3 years have been, at the later end, 1760, I just missed the American Revolution, and at the earlier end, the strangely unclear on the concept guess of 800 BC. You know, you just don't know where to start with that student, you know. Better informed students tend to guess around AD 1200, perhaps because they can't imagine anything happening before such a remote date. They are uniformly surprised to learn that Patrick must have lived between AD 350 and AD 490. And that, of course, is a pretty wide span, which I'll be talking about. The vast and contentious modern literature on Patrick might make one think that pretty much everything that could be discovered or hypothesized about him must have been said by somebody somewhere. He was born in Wales, according to the literature, or in Cornwall, or in Huntingdonshire, or Cumbria, or Scotland. He died in the 430s, or the 450s, or the 460s, or the 490s. Strangely, nobody's opted for the 480s. I don't know why, but he survived those, perhaps. He spoke Latin fluently or poorly. He was a monk. He was not a monk. He studied at Auxerre, in Lérin, nowhere. He went to Rome, or he didn't. He was at least one person, and possibly two, or maybe even three. I'm not making this stuff up, folks. This state of affairs is pretty distressing, especially considering that, unlike anybody else in the British Isles in the 5th century, Patrick went to the trouble of leaving us a sort of biographical sketch as part of his confessio. According to the now standard popular account of Patrick's life and mission, which you can get on Wikipedia and elsewhere, Patrick was born, usually anachronistically, in England, Wales, or Scotland, none of which could have existed in any reasonable sense in the 4th century. I mean, the Anglo-Saxons hadn't even made it to Britain yet, so England is really out as a designation. Born around 388, captured as a slave at 16 and spent some years in Ireland, went back to Ireland as a he escaped and then went back to Ireland as a missionary in the year 432. He converted Leary MacNeil, the southern O'Neill king at Tara, around 445, and died in either 462 or 493, according to the annals. But most of the information in these accounts doesn't come from the actual patrician documents. Patrick left 2 documents, written in Latin, and totaling only 1,000 to 2,000 words. One, the letter to the soldiers of Caroticus, and the other, the Confessio. Our earliest texts of these documents are from the late 7th century, but they can be shown to be from originals which were written down before the early 7th century Irish scribal invention of word separation. People don't think about this, but in the ancient world, when they wrote manuscripts, they didn't separate the words. The Romans and the Greeks, they just wrote them all the words together. And so your slaves who would be reading to you had to first decide where the word boundaries were and then where the sentences were and so on and so forth. So that's why you had slaves to read to you instead of having to do it yourself. It's tedious business. But the Irish, having learned Latin as adults, uniquely in the Roman Empire, and taken up Christianity rather late, found that it was much easier to write if you put little spaces between the words. And so they started to do that. And that's why we do it now. But they started doing that between the year 600 and 620, we know with absolute certainty. So the fact that some of these patrician documents clearly were written in what's called scripta continua, without the breaks, and we know this because the later manuscripts break them up in different places. So we know they're working from an original that has these things written together, which they don't understand perfectly. Anyway, so we know the documents go back before 600. The earlier letter is a public excoriation of a British king named Caradocus, who had taken captives from a baptismal celebration in Ireland. The confession is a defense against unspecified charges. It's like one end of a telephone conversation. You know, he's answering some kind of complaint, and we don't know exactly what the complaint is. The confession is a defense against unspecified charges brought against Patrick by some British seniores, either elders in age or superiors in the church, or both, who are otherwise unspecified. I began my present project of reanalyzing Patrick's formal rhetoric about 3 years ago, inspired by the work of Dr. David Howlett, to reconsider the received notion that Patrick's writings were the ill-educated work of a post- or sub-Roman Briton, writing in the in a mid-5th century world of fragmented, disrupted, and partially forgotten Roman culture. Howlett's work is controversial in detail, but his demonstration that imperial Roman rhetorical style persisted literarily into the late Middle Ages is compelling, and my own analysis shows that Patrick had considerable training in Roman formal rhetoric and letter writing. The problem for us is that although Patrick left actual writings, those writings contain not a single date or datable personal name or place name. In the letter, he is trying to arrange to ransom some captives from a British king, and in the confessions, who's otherwise unknown, he's just a name, and in the confession, he's defending himself in some sort of formal or informal legal action. In neither document is he leaving a biographical account for the future. What biographical information he offers, which includes where he was born, the fact that he, his father and grandfather were Roman magistrates, and that his father and grandfather were a deacon and a priest, respectively, are offered as part of his ethical appeal, his presentation of his own character, and not for some undreamt of posterity. He didn't know we were going to be here. The lack of such information in the primary text has led to reliance on other medieval statements about Patrick, largely from the promoters of his cult and of the claim that he is the national apostle. The Southern Enail decided that they were going to become the kings of all Ireland from Tara and invented that notion in the 8th or 9th century, and since they had in their territory lay Armagh, which is where Patrick's chief shrine was, they decided he was going to be the national apostle. And so between them, they pushed this agenda, and we see this over and over again in these later works. There are a few early sources for the documents and legends. One, the Book of Armagh, which was written about 700, which contains the patrician texts themselves. The later things, but early, are the three early saints' lives, that is, written before 802, by Muircu, Tirachan, and the so-called tripartite life, which was really a collection of three sermons about probably given on 17th of March as the celebration of Patrick's death. But the one thing that all these latter, and also the mentions of his birth and death in the Irish annals, the thing that all these latter sources share is that they're virtually as clueless as we are about the elements of Patrick's life outside the patrician documents. It's pretty clear that many of the so-called traditions and acts attributed to Patrick in these saints' lives and in the annals are cooked up somehow out of the little information they can glean from his own documents. There's very little evidence that there's any kind of continuing oral tradition or whatever. They don't even know where he's buried. They know he died in Saulpatrick, what is now called Saulpatrick in County Down, but they don't know, even as early as 700, where if there is any shrine to his grave or any place where he died. So later they decide they know, but they're cooking that up too. So in the very death entries in the annals, which are at 463 and 492, the annalists, who are clearly writing this down sometime in the 9th century, each entry knows about the other entry. And that is that the 492 entry refers to the 463 entry and vice versa. So we know these are not independent recordings of something that he did. This is guys who were very desperate to figure out their own historical chronology. Because they've been getting along fine until Christianity, and they had their own chronology of where they came from and who their ancestors were, and then all of a sudden they've got the Bible, they've got Roman history, they've got Greek history, in the middle of the 5th century, and they've got to make this somehow stick this all together and make it work. And they spend the rest of the Middle Ages unsuccessfully attempting to do this. I call this the big project. Anyway, to make Patrick fit into the sources they had to have Patrick who arrived in Ireland in after 431. There was a document about the Pope Celestine sending a guy called Palladius as the first bishop over the Irish believing in Christ. And so they had, since they had, that document was there and it was contemporary 5th century document, they had to make up a story, which was that Palladius died on the way and Patrick took over. So that's why Patrick could be the first bishop, you see. Well, what's wrong with that? And also they needed Patrick to be old enough so that he could or live long enough to be working with Leary McNeil, whom they dated as being king at Tara in the 450s. What's wrong with this picture? And my answer drives you to Occam's razor, that is, that you shouldn't posit more complicated explanations than are necessary. That account, the medieval Irish account, can be made to accord with the known facts from the patrician text, but like the Ptolemaic earth-centered astronomy, it requires way too much special pleading to make it work. For instance, Patrick says in the letter that he financed his mission by selling his nobilitas, presumably his Roman magistrate's title and perhaps the landholding that guaranteed that status. If he was born in 388, captured as a slave at 16, and spent some years back at home before heeding the call to return to Ireland in 432, he supposedly carried out this sale sometime between, say, 405 and 431, more likely toward the end of that period. Who was buying Roman titles in Britain after 405? Is anybody lining up to get to for positions in Saddam Hussein's government right now? Not worth much. The imperial civil wars in the Western Empire and the crisis caused by the massive incursions of the Franks across the Rhine in the late 4th century, and those of you who, of course, have seen Gladiator will know about this, caused the virtual abandonment of Britain by the Romans after 410, the famous rescript of Honorius. Believers in a late Patrick just write this fact off as if it didn't exist. Likewise, Patrick's intense theological interest in Trinitarianism and the confession he's at great lengths to explain that he believes in the Trinity, that he's always believed in the Trinity, that anybody who's a good Christian believes in the Trinity. That was a huge issue in the late 4th century in Western Christianity and had been completely settled by the year 430. Nobody was openly claiming they weren't a Trinitarian, because they'd, you know, burn you at the stake or accuse you of being a Lombard or something else. Likewise, he has no interest in Pelagianism, a heresy which our man Palladius was actually sent to stamp out. Patrick apparently doesn't even know it's a heresy or know it exists, so that's very odd if he's writing in the 430s. His Latin has generally been accused of rusticity, but though it does not meet the standards of Cicero or even of Patrick's contemporary, St. Augustine, it now appears, from my own studies, to be far more sophisticated than it has been given credit for. And as a rhetorician, it seems to me stunning that Latin scholars would take Patrick's own statements. He calls himself indoctus, untutored, and rusticissimus, the most rustic, the most countrified, as literal statements rather than what they are, an essential feature of the opening humility topos in any personal speech given by one trained in rhetoric from about 450 BC on. You know, it's Perry Mason saying, unaccustomed as I am to appearing before a jury. At the same time, the standard account treats without comment as simple hyperbole Patrick's statement that he was captured, quote, with so many thousands of others when he was 16 and taken to Ireland. If we move Patrick's birth back to about 351, however, all these problems disappear. Roman Britain was a going concern in the mid-4th century. Young Patrick would have had a reasonable education for the son of a magistrate who would inherit his father's place. The Roman and Greek universal curriculum, popular in the empire, would have taken him through grammar, logic, and at least some of rhetoric by the age of 16, which probably means 15 because the Romans did inclusive reckoning anyway, even in an out-of-the-way corner of the northernmost province. If Patrick sold his patrimony before 395, it probably still had some worth. If he went to Ireland then around 395, it would make sense that his writings date from before 420 and thus would be concerned with pre-Pelagian theological issues. And if he died before 430 at the age of 80-ish, the Irish believing in Christ might very well have requested a bishop such as Palladius in that year since they'd lost the one they had. Notable in this last regard is the fact that in the Confessio, Patrick seems to be defending himself stoutly against the charge that he's appointed himself a bishop without being properly installed by his superiors back in Britain. So from an outside perspective, Palladius would then be the first bishop, the primus episcopus. What about the thousands of other captives? There's one moment at which this statement would be literally true and not hyperbole, and that is in the years 367-368, the great barbarian uprising, in which a conspiracy of local kings in Ireland and north and central Britain rose up against the Romans and created havoc for more than a year, capturing several cities and legionary camps. A Patrick born in 350 or 351 would have been 16 years old and a likely candidate for a profitable slave sale at that time. Why disbelieve him on this point? So it seems to me that the 20th century drift toward a later Patrick, that is, one who died around in the 490s, is becoming harder and harder to sustain, and the hypothesis that Patrick was, rather than a figure of the disintegration of the empire in Britain, an exact contemporary of Augustine of Hippo and a product of the fullness of that later empire of the West. Thank you very much. Sean?
Sure. Hi. Good evening. I don't think I need the mic. Can everybody hear me? Tell me if you can't. Okay. So just excuse me a second. Cool. So I want to thank the World Affairs Council for inviting us. I want to thank you all for coming, and want to thank Dan for all the help and support he's given us here as strangers in this country over the past number of years. What's fascinating about this is we were talking about Patrick at a time when Christianity is finally dying in Ireland. Unquestionably, it's on its way out. And it's actually worth having a look at really what it is and what it means, what it's supplanted, and what's likely to replace it. I'm obviously not going to even dream of going too far into that right now, except we do know in Northern Europe there was one pretty serious attempt to extirpate all traces of Christianity in the last 20 years, and it's the famous church burnings in Norway in the early 1990s. I hope it doesn't come to that in Ireland, but this was in connection with an awful lot of heavy metal bands and satyricon bands like that. And it's actually, so far, the precedent for the actual revenge, if you like, by a nation on Christianity is not good. It's not looking good. And something like that, what currently is happening in Ireland is that instead of this direct attack on the sites of Christianity, what's happening instead is an insistence that anybody connected with clerical sex abuse scandals, including currently, today, as we speak, the Irish people have asked that the government prosecute the head of the church in Ireland, Sean Brady. So this is the kind of thing that's happening there, and it's the final revulsion as they get rid of it. But I'm not really going to go too far into that tonight. What I'm going to talk about is Irish language, slang and poetry. Now, the slang in particular is really, really interesting because a lot of you speak a lot more Irish than you think. Okay? You speak Irish every day, all of you. I'm going to prove that. Okay? So here we go. The first thing is Irish is a Celtic language. It's a verb subject object like most of them and may have come to Ireland about 500 BC. We have hints that there was in fact perhaps a prior version of Irish stroke Celtic in existence in Ireland before then, but let's just take this as a median date. There's no written language before that point anyway, so it's always going to be a matter of speculation. So VSO, what do we mean by that? It means that the all the sentences start with a verb. And the joke was, this is why the Irish are really bad at organisation, because the verb comes first and you go off and do the thing before it's specified in the rest of the sentence. So there are about 19% of the world's languages are verb, subject, object. It's very interesting parallels with some of the languages that are spoken around Oaxaca in Mexico, and a deal of research has been done into that. Here is a really fascinating thing, though, is that sophisticated buildings date from 3000 BC in Ireland, and the population seems to have arrived from about 7800 BC. Now, we do have the DNA tests at this stage, and it's revealed some in many cases, dreadful things. Has anybody been watching that Henry Gates series on ancestors and so on public TV? It's that African American guy who actually had the row with the Irish cop, famously, which Obama needed to get the two of them together to have a beer. And that what they call that? Yes, three cans, which I thought was very good. So Henry Gates actually found he was looking at his own DNA, and he found he was actually Irish. Seriously, he actually found that his DNA arose from Dan spoke about the O'Neills, the O'Neill family, who were the High Kings. So Patrick was most likely taken by a historical figure called Neil Ní Iallach, nine of the nine hostages, O'Neill. And it looks very much like this guy, Neil Ní Iallach, like Genghis Khan, basically dominated the women in his area to the point that there are about 3 million descendants of Neil Ní Iallach in the northeastern United States alone. And one of them is actually Henry Gates. So he actually found that he was Irish. They found these markers on his Y chromosome. So again, this is the same thing they found in the case of Genghis Khan. It's about 10% of the population of Central Asia are direct descendants of him. And again, this is the sort of... So what we're finding, when they started doing the DNA on Irish people, they found that the figures were not actually making sense. It looked like the population had, in some cases, went back to 7,800 BC. In others, it looked like it was going to be a lot more recent. And it's only when they mixed in this fact that actually, essentially, only a few select males were allowed to reproduce, that it does actually make sense. So all this is in... a lot of the work was done in Trinity College in Bradley's genetics lab there. That's the one that Henry Gates goes to in the series. And there's a book called Blood of the Isles, which goes into it in most detail. We do seem to... The median estimate of when the population arrived there is 7,800 BC... We're pretty sure now that it was it was migration that came up through Spain, France, and went into both Britain and Ireland. And it looks like the British and the Irish are actually very close, very closely genetically related. There were more population influxes into Britain. There were more invasions, frankly, and the country was colonised more than Ireland was. But the original population stock in both places seemed to have been about the same. There are few, very few, Celtic monuments in Ireland and very little sign of an influx from Central Europe. So it's important to get this out of the way. Irish is a Celtic language, but really in terms of some kind of massive colonisation from Central Europe, we have actually very little evidence that anything like that happened. Briefly here, what we're going to look at is language, slang and poetry. So the Celtic influence then, in my opinion, it's consistent to suggest that Indo-European culture travelled through the Saudi Peninsula to get to Europe. I'm going to give you some proofs of that in a moment. So we've got a notion that we've got a culture of the Indus Valley in what we now call India, and it goes through Saudi Arabia. It actually ends up in Central Europe. It goes to the remote islands like Ireland, and it's in Ireland that a very, very pure version of aspects of that culture gets preserved. So it's a remarkable piece of cultural preservation. I'm going to show you in a few examples in a moment. Nor is it beggaring to believe to suggest that aspects of it were preserved on the outskirts like Ireland. We have other little relics like the shamrock, Middle Eastern word for the trefoil, and nira. Okay, so the shamrock is not an Irish word, it's not an Irish concept, it's actually an Arabic concept. And the word is itself from the Middle East. It's not an Irish word, nothing to do with Ireland whatsoever. Really, sorry, nothing. Another is Nira, and Nira is an interesting character. He appears in an awful lot of Irish stories, and we see him appearing in an old Indian story about the hanged man who's neither dead nor alive. And Nira appears in the story in exactly the same protagonist role as the original Indus Valley story. In the same way, there's another figure called Nuada, who's got one arm, who's lost his arm, and they give him a silver arm for battle. And this is an Arabic story. So we do have pretty much clear proof that these old Celtic stories in Ireland preserve an awful lot of this old culture. The analogies continue. These include the free castes in both India and Ireland. In both of them, there are three free castes, and they map pretty much precisely onto each other. And in the Book of Invasions, which is meant to be the, if you like, the original history of Ireland, we find pretty much precise analogies with an awful lot of the Indian texts. The Sons of Mill the last invasion of Ireland, we are meant to be, Melanie, myself and Dan are meant to be, if you like, the descendants of the Sons of Mill, and these map up precisely onto seven gods in the Indian pantheon. Cernunnos freaked me out so much when I saw it first that I put it on the cover of one of my books. Cernunnos is a Celtic figure in full lotus position. He's sitting there like Buddha. He's often also seen, he becomes a nature god. Buddha, if you like, becomes a nature god in the domestication of this religion in both Britain and Ireland, and he gets horns. But if you look at Cernunnos, he actually is sitting there in a full lotus position. So we do know for a fact that this is authentic, because the Vikings did us the great service of actually basically despoiling some of our graveyards and bringing them to places like Osberg, where you can find the Cernunnos figure in full lotus position. So I actually put this on the cover of one of my books. To be honest with you, I as somebody who was brought up Catholic, was as astonished by this stuff as probably most of you are at the moment. It can consistently be argued that the Druidic religion entered into a productive dialogue with Christianity, with a Vedanta-flavoured pantheism emerging. I consider this important now because pantheism is the notion that God inheres in the world, that God is present in the world. And there is a monk in Benedictine Abbey called Glen Stoll, called Sean O'Din, who's been beavering away at this for the best part of 50 years at this stage. And what he argues is that essentially the Druids were not very happy with Christianity. We can guarantee you that. When Christianity came, they were pretty much like the heavy metal fans in Norway and Christianity at the moment. They were not happy, and they documented their unhappiness with it. What Odin says is that some kind of synthesis emerged. So, for example, in a book he wrote called Orhi Cosinta, a book about the prayers of protection, there is a famous hymn in the Christian tradition called St. Patrick's Breastplate, Christ be before me, Christ be behind me, Christ in my left hand, Christ in my right hand. And what Odin says is that this is a quote directly from the Chandogya Upanishad. And the idea, the infinite is before me, the infinite is behind me, the infinite is to my left, to my right. With Christianity dying in Ireland, all this is again becoming of urgent relevance. So, to the language. Sorry, I thought there was a question. There's a wonderful book came out a few years back called How the Irish Invented Slang. And it was done by the head of the Irish Studies Department here in San Francisco, Danny Casty, may he rest in peace. And he had a fantastic ear for language. He grew up in New York in conditions where he was in a position to hear an awful lot of the language that was going on around him. But the some of the analogies with Irish and African-American slang are things that, as an Irish speaker, strike you immediately. So, for example, do you dig? Okay? In Gaelic, you ask somebody do you understand, is on digging to. So you would actually often say, dig. This is not invented. This is absolutely... I'm going to leave this one here, the 86, for a moment, because I actually think in some ways it's the best of them. Galore is another one. For example, whiskey galore. Ta ishke biaha galore agam. It's precisely the same. Galore is actually an Irish word. Similarly, the classic one is obviously smithereens. Smithereens is nothing to do with any other Indo-European language. It's an Irish word. And inserted without any kind of ceremony into the English language. Smashing is a really good one. You know, what do you think of Irish music? It's smashing. It's more British than American, I guess. But in Irish, if you want to say something is good, you say ismashin. Ismashin. Smashing. Ismashin. So there are literally, Danny comes up with a few hundred of these. I have a huge skepticism about some of them. I think his masterpiece was the 86th one. Does anybody know what being 86th means?
Kicked out of a bar.
Yeah. So, yeah, okay.
Kicked out of a bar.
Yeah. Okay, okay.
Had 86
of them. So some people I met here didn't. So in Irish, to be 86 like that is etichus iacht. Etichus iacht. Etichus refusal, iacht is hospitality. Etichus iacht, 86th. There's no other way that this could have come in to English. So I recommend Danny's book very much. Many of the others, as I said, in his book, not so much, but I think those ones in particular, I think, prove his case that a huge amount of Irish got into the African-American vernacular and into the rest of American English. So we're going to end with some music here, and poetry declensions, conjugations. Irish has a case structure much like Latin and German, so the noun mutates according to whether it's in the nominative case or whether it's a possessive, whether you're giving something to somebody, dative case, or in general a locative case. So Irish, German, and Latin are all pretty similar like that. Now, it has many conjugations and declensions. So what we mean by conjugations is that the verbs have different forms. What we mean by declensions is that the nouns have different forms. And Irish brings this to an extreme which is almost unspeakable in some ways. We have some friends in LA, one guy who's Armenian. They learn Irish and they have a little workshop. They work together in Starbucks every week. And I don't think it's the coffee, but the guy said when he saw the number of forms for the first declension in Irish plural, he said he almost got ill. It's actually, we counted one day, it's over 100 different forms. So, for example, iasc, word for fish, the plural is eiscna. In general, you have more simpler things like madra, madri, dog, dogs, but the words mutate an awful lot. But there's much opportunity for rhyme, including internal rhyme. And I have to say, as somebody who grew up speaking Irish, it was shocking to read Shakespeare's sonnets after Irish. It's not controversial to suggest that the Irish were much better poets at that period. Really, if you honestly read what they were at during that period, it's just way ahead. So what we're going to do quickly is we're just going to give you an example of song in the Irish language. The first is a song which uses bossa nova rhythm to complement the... verse lib, the blank verse that Melanie will sing. So Mel, if you'd like to come up.
Mm-hmm. I just want to bring my stuff. This is fresh, right? Fresh, right?
Yeah, sure.
This is from a poem by Nuala Nigonal. And Nuala Nigonal is one of our great Irish language poets who's still alive, and we work with her collaborating on new music, but with Irish language. And this she wrote in a book called The Astrakhan Cloak, and we adapted it. And Fesh is it's a passionate love poem. Nure dag is tu heran gay and that Tascal trin shaw will voir. Nure agus tú ar an ggéanach Tascail trín seáhfuil bhir. Mis cí an trín príú, mis ceat trín lethú a chníon faoimiúcha. Mis cí an trín críú, mis ceat trín lethú a chníon faoimiúcha. As glian rós is dí an crí lára chuach an bhéil. Leimann gheag a gom an iad Tá toin ma vatnas I nainas ma vatnas Lára cuach im bai Núr as glian ma hiúla Eag teacht an nís chan air Núr as glian an hiúla Eag teacht an nís chan air Stada an greens and races bear off a blean is lay, her carbuina lesh and pleasure. The stada on greens and races bear off a blean is lay, her carbuina lesh and pleasure. As clean roses, gee and cree, Lara cool convey. Layman gap, you go, man yad, ta toin ma vatnas, he ninas ma vatnav, Lara cool convey. You were a knife through my heart. You were a briar in my fist. You were a bit of grit between my teeth. A rose opens in my heart. A cuckoo sings in my throat. A dolphin plunges through my deepest thoughts.
So that was an example of the modern Irish poem by a great poet called Nuala Ní Gonaill, and it was written in verse libre. So bossa nova, some of you know, is all those cross rhythms and so on going on in it. So what we do is we play the language against the music like that. So by complete contrast, the next one we're going to do is about the after about the 16th century, the British basically made it illegal for harpists to play. In fact, it was a capital offence to be a harpist. That's actually true. They were hanging them. So we lost an awful lot of the harmonic accompaniment of the music which was going on, and the harmonic accompaniment was actually very sophisticated. So we're often left with this single note melody, and we have to reconstruct what we think the harmonic accompaniment was. This is a tune that was discovered in the early 19th century. I decided that it sounded like a saraband, which is mainly Bach wrote a lot of sarabands, so did a French composer called Robert de Vizet. So what we did was we put the, again, it's Nuala Ní Gonaill's lyrics together with the melody over the harmonic structure and rhythm of a saraband. And again, we have no idea if what we're doing is historically accurate or not. We're doing our best. But you'll find in this case the form is an awful lot stricter.
So this is called Anora an Cúil Ómar, which originally was as Sean mentioned, a melody, an old melody, which was collected by Reverend Canon Goodman, who collected 3,000 tunes before the Great Famine, which is just as well because many of them would have been lost. And that collection is in the Trinity College Dublin now. So Anora an Cúil Ómar, we believe the original words were lost. Nuala Ní Gonaill believes very strongly that there were original lyrics. And she has brought it to life again by putting Irish to the melody. And it's very much a love song, but in the vein of Romeo and Juliet, where two families are feuding, so the relationship can't last. But there's a lovely verse at the end, Bear Buulat Gadiodo, may you have blessings forever. So that's the gist of it. Ah, Annorum culomer da varitum Christi da culdu latulanac erchamanam nasci na lit me emliapa fui yasav dramatriota isnir cadu me neilat annorum yagma crui. Isanora culomer, lenerev me shall, y dramor, da vede abashun, ni ligam quigan la. Fima winchir, stu winchir, in irage lena kela, is near lig sheet fa tailing, an nor of yag McCree. Da la da 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 Bua ha bua gniv, bua halya bua slancha, bua si is bua shasiv, bua shul is bua tashtil, an nor of yug mogri. An nor of Thanks, Sean. So now, on that note, I'm going to talk a little bit of my research project, which I did, which really got me over to the United States. And again, I'm going to personally thank Professor Dan Milia for helping me and being my sponsor and being so supportive during my time in UC Berkeley. And thank you, Dan. This was called Women Who Left. And basically, I'm not an academic, I'm not a historian, but I do love history and I do love my own Irish history. My own music brings together Irish tradition and jazz traditions. That's two big traditions of Ireland and America. And that gave rise to writing songs and researching some of the history, because I'm very taken by place names and history of and how the language gives, if you like, a key into history. And although I'm not an Irish native speaker, I do sing Irish. I've got a feel for it. I was also taught how to sing in Irish by a classical singer who was also a native speaker, a native Irish speaker. So just like a classical singer will learn how to sing in German or Italian without necessarily being a fluent speaker, you can learn to sing it fluently. So while I was writing songs, I was asked by the Sirius Arts Centre in Cove, which is southwest Ireland, which is through which the great harbour, a very deep harbour there, and it's through Cove that many thousands of immigrants emigrated to the United States. So I was asked by the Sirius Arts Centre to write songs and collaborate on this because The song cycle was based on the history of various women who left Ireland in the 19th century through the town and the harbour of Cove. Not much is known of Irish women's unique experience of emigration. More is known about Irish men's emigration in the 19th century. So I focused on three specific women and their unique experience of emigration. The personal histories echo the plight of others. And I responded, if you like, as an artist by giving voice to these women. They've been forgotten about in their own land until fairly recently. Through that, I became almost like attached to these women and what the world must have looked like to them coming from a country which at the time was full of homelessness and impoverishment and, of course, giving rise to a pattern of emigration long before the Great Famine. But in the 19th century, I started with a woman called Moira O'Sullivan, and she came from Dingle, County Kerry, in the west of Ireland. She would have spoken Irish at the time, and I got to know about her through one of her descendants who lives in Canada, and her name was Marie O'Connor. We still keep in touch. And Marie, in fact, answered a query. I sent out an email to various places, looking at the various emigration patterns, and she responded. So Moira O'Sullivan actually emigrated to Canada, but she was one of the family who she was a young girl at the time, and her mother was already passed away. We don't quite know why or how that happened, but they lived in a little cottage. They had their plot, but because of eviction and impoverishment, they were made homeless, and there was this a chance to apply to an assisted emigration scheme, which Peter Robinson, the English, he was actually Canadian-British. He was the man put in charge of assistant immigration. He put two in motion, and it was the 1825 settlement that she and her family emigrated from Dingle through Cove to Canada, and ended up in a place which is now called Peterborough in Ontario. They emigrated on the John Barry, which is the name of the boat. And as I said, life in Ireland at the time was pretty grim in the 19th century and early 19th century particularly. So the ships at the time that they would have crossed on were... this was pre-Great Famine, so they were pretty grim also. So in my music, I put in that, if you like, that feeling of the storms, because they do write about the storms and the deaths, a few deaths on the ship. And then when they arrived at the Otanabee River, they actually got ill, and they still had to, you know, travel up through the river to eventually get to the area which is now called Peterborough, and they were given plots of land. So they were actually given a home, which is more than they had in Ireland. So that was a new life for them. And of course, what's so amazing now is that the descendants of that settlement are now, you know, professional people who have done very well. Now, just to tell you a little bit about the... there is a little bit of the history that I discovered was... an article that was written at the time when the settlement, the groups of people about to embark on their journey, there were 2,000 people on those ships. It was about 6 ships. And they all gathered in this tiny little place called Cove. It's a deep harbour, but it's a tiny little place. And another 2,000 people came to see them off. So there's this very moving newspaper article that was written about that emigration and the fact that 2,000 people were going off to leave Ireland, never to see their family again, of course, at that time. And yet, and the 2,000 people seeing them off, and that the newspaper article actually writes about how you could hear the wailing from the shore. So I'm just going to sing a cappella, a song which myself and Sean wrote, but it's based from that article. And I'm going to sing it just to give you a little idea of the picture, shall we say. And we call it Hall the Bowline because there is an island called Hall Bowline Island just off the cove. And the black ships, they called it the black ships, were the huge ships that the immigrants had to go off in the little boats to reach them. So here we go. As I descend the hill of Cove, the black ships lie in view. 4,000 people crowd the shore, seems like my heart's in two. Some of us are bound to leave, the others will be left behind. And always I will hear the cry, all the Bowline. 'Twas May of 1825, we all were gathered round like sheep. The roll is called, the bell is rung, now we haven't time to weep. Some will faint and some will wait, lovers' arms are still entwined. And always I will hear the cry, all the Bowline. And as I strain my eyes to see, the green hills disappear. I press my body to the rail, my knuckles white and wet with tears. Hear the wailing from the shore, the others that are left behind. And always I will hear the cry, all the Bowline. So thank you. So Moira Sulawan arrived, as I said, with her family. The John Barry, by the way, what's interesting, when we were first bringing that album out, it's all in an album called Women Who Left Now. During the time we've been here, we've managed to record all the songs. Now, we brought it out in Ireland also, and we were on radio, and we were singing some of those songs, and we got an email from somebody who'd been doing a research on the John Barry, and on, in fact, the Doctor's Journal. And so that's very interesting. So now we were able to put all that together with the Peterborough Museum, because that's all now part of the Peterborough Museum. So I'm very interested to see how one thing leads to another. So she arrived, as I said, to find that, you know, her family were able to build a home there. So she had a good story. The next person that I wrote about was Nellie Cashman, who is very well known now in certain areas in America. She came from Cove, Belvelli to be correct, just beside Cove, and she was, we're not quite sure whether she, what exact year she was born. Some people say she was born in 1845, some people say she was born in 1850. We think she was actually they emigrated in somewhere around the 1845, and she came with her mother and sister. And she arrived through Boston, and they stayed there for a while, and she became an elevator operator. And the story is that she heard stories about the gold rush from people in the elevator. And she was about 16 when she was an elevator operator. She was already working hard, you know. And she went to emigrate then to the West over here. And she became a gold miner and an entrepreneur. And there's you could do a whole show about Nellie Cashman herself. I think I might do that one day. She's known as the Frontier Angel, Saint of the Sourdoughs, the Miner's Angel, Angel of Tombstone, and Angel of the West, because She was known to be very feisty, and she was apparently quite a small lady. There are photos of her now, and she was able to, as I said, live amongst the men, and yet be, she was very an entrepreneur as well, because she was an owner of boarding houses and restaurants, and was apparently a great cook, so that's how you got Saint of the Sourdoughs there. She was also known to save 500 miners from scurvy and starvation, because in British Columbia they were mining there, and she heard that they had been cut off by snow and the weather, and they were a group of miners she knew. So she said, okay, let's go and save them. So she got a pack of dogs and a few men, I think five other men, and she went off and found them and got, you know, it had food, proper food for them. So she really became a legend after that. She is remembered in Tombstone in Arizona every year. There's an Ellie Cashman Day, because she opened up a place there, a restaurant, and she eventually, she didn't marry, but her sister, who was married and had children, actually died, and she both, it's quite sad really, but she did become a mother to the children as well, and she managed all of this, and yet became continued on to be a gold miner. She raised money for various charities, and she put money into hospitals particularly, as well as churches, and she actually passed away peacefully in one of the nursing homes that she'd put money into. So it's a great story. She was really a true pioneer, very inspiring, I think. And the third lady that I wrote songs about and researched was Annie Moore, who emigrated in 1892. She actually is now known to be the first official immigrant to the United States, because she arrived on New Year's Day, 1892, at Ellis Island, which was the first day of the opening of the official Ellis Island Immigration Center. So there were immigrants before that, of course, who went through there, but that was the official opening. She, the story is that what we do know is she came from Cork, the town of Cork, and she, her mother and father had already emigrated to New York 3 years previously, and she was only 15, and she brought her two brothers with her and arrived on her 16th birthday, actually. So what a very interesting story, again, from a newspaper article. She arrived having been on the ship for 6 weeks, and she had her two brothers, and she'd befriended Michael Tierney, one of the Irish men on the boat who was kind of looking after her. And they were about to disembark at the center, at the port and of Ellis Island, and she, apparently a German man was going to rush on first, but Michael Tierney pulled him back and said, ladies first. So, you know, Annie Moore was the first person to disembark and ran up the stairs to great cheers, was given a golden $10 gold coin as a result. So it's all documented, that. You know, and joined her parents with her brothers. Now, when I first did this research, the history that I found and researched, I found out it looked as if she had moved to Indiana after that, eventually marrying a man called Daniel O'Connell, and had seven children, and ended up in New Mexico and was a restaurant owner, and was killed at the age of 47 by a freight train. But in fact, that part of the story was all wrong. And because I'm just going to read out very quickly, about 2 years ago we discovered that there was a newspaper article in the front of New York Times that more research had been done on the Annie Moore who had arrived from Cove in 1892. And this was not the same Annie Moore that went to Mexico. So somehow the two got mixed up. And so the newspaper article in the New York Times there recently, or not so long ago, the Annie Moore who was 15, who arrived in 1892, never moved west. She lived the rest of her life within a few square blocks on Manhattan's Lower East Side and died at 99 Cherry Street. One of her granddaughters lived in a public housing project in the neighborhood until her death in 2001. So she The researchers who found this out was Mrs. Smolenik, and she had 11 children. She married a bakery clerk, and she apparently was a seamstress, and she lived a poor immigrant's life, but her descendants multiplied and many prospered. And the full story can be read in the September 14th, 2006 edition of the New York Times. But what's interesting is that they had a big reunion in Ellis Island about Annie Moore, and her, many of her descendants gathered. And so she is seen very much as a symbol of modern America because of the multiplication of the, you know, all the in multicultural descendants. And I think that's a wonderful story, really, and it's great that she's remembered. So I think on that note, I should end. And I hope we've given you some taste of Irish culture and history and language and music. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, at this point, we'll be taking the next 5 to 10 minutes for questions from the audience. You can either stand up and speak loudly or come to the mic up front here.
I just had a question about that immigration rate. So which government was organizing the Irish to come to North America? Was it the Irish government or the
British government?
The British government.
Yeah.
And why were they, just what was the rationale behind that? It's just cheaper to ship them away?
It was part of a movement, if you like, to
clear the land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is interesting to see. I've done a lot of, we've actually found Peter Robinson's letters. And in fact, what I didn't mention is that we're now writing a show with Professor Peter Glaser in the performance department of UC Berkeley. We're putting together, if you like, the research into this new show. But it's been fascinating as an artist to have an actor read the letters, and the fact that he wasn't the worst in the sense that, you know, he did manage to find homes for some people and who were very grateful at the time. On the other hand, he was an instrument of the British colonial empire at the time. So it's complicated. I think you might. I'm not sure if you want to say any more about that, but I'm not the historian here. But
well, I mean, you look at the bright side. I mean, the famine and so on happened at just the right time for the Irish. It forced them out of Ireland and into North America, just at exactly the right time. It's just when North America was developing. It actually worked out for the best. The methodology was not very ethical or anything like that. But even if you think of very simple things, like if the Italians had gotten here before the Irish, you know, there are an awful lot of parts of... in fact, instead of the Mafia, you would have some kind of Irish equivalent, which the Irish would be associated with.
Not that we entirely lack those in New York.
No, but we're not. We never really.
Whiskeys were still operating.
That's
in the 80s.
Right, we never. But then we never really had to organize them at quite the same level of sophistication. Undoubtedly the Irish blocked the Italians from any kind of control over the Catholic Church here.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting that. St. Patrick is the co-patron of San Francisco. And the reason for that is that the Irish came here and prospered in the late 19th century, and a delegation of large contributors actually went to Rome and petitioned the Pope to make St. Patrick the co-patron of San Francisco, which he duly did.
Why do you suppose the Irish that came to New York were so attracted to becoming policemen? What is that tradition about?
Well, this also was a sort of upward, the police forces were a new deal, were a whole new thing in the 19th century. I mean, the people had private police forces and so on and so forth, and this was an entry-level civil service job for people who were big and strong and not particularly well-educated, and also that kind of civil service job became tied to the political organizations like Tammany Hall. I just saw something the other day about Big Tim Sullivan in the New York Times, who was the organizer of the Lower East Side in New York from 1880 to 1900. And so these things went together. It was a patronage job. It was a job they could do. Most of them spoke English. So it was a job they could do. And, of course, once one of them got the job, then as immigrant populations do, your brother-in-law got the job, and then his son got the job, and so on and so forth. And you see the same thing with other immigrant groups particularly you can see it in New York. I mean, the Irish move, the Irish then stop being cops and become lawyers and judges, then the Italians become the cops, then they become the lawyers and the judges, so...
And the FBI now,
yes.
I think.
Answer to that question, and that is that there really were snakes in Ireland, and St. Patrick drove them all into the Atlantic, and they swam across and came up in New York and became kings.
Yes, yeah. Well, I endorse that completely.
Yeah. A question following on the St. Patrick coming in, you kind of mentioning kind of this identification of the Catholic Church with Ireland so strongly. Has that always been the case? Is that something of a recent, like over the last couple of centuries, or was Ireland more Catholic, more Christian than other areas of Europe, even in the 400s? Do we know?
Well, not in the 400s because they were just getting started, but yeah, by the 600s, they're sending missionaries out into the Frankish territories and right down the Rhine River. The standard to which we if you're doing an edition of an old Irish text, that is something written in Irish between, say, 700 and 800, the standard we use is glosses on a Latin text, which were, the manuscript is at Bobbio, which is just outside Milan, which was the southernmost monastery founded by St. Columbanus in the 7th century. So from a very early period, they saw themselves as missionaries, they saw themselves as converting the Anglo-Saxons and the Germans in general, and went all the way down into northern Italy. So this was and they became exporters of missionaries all through from the 16th century on, and of course they became defensively Catholic when the English crown became aggressively Protestant, and so the Catholic families like the Stuarts, who were trying to get back in control, came in through Ireland. This is the Battle of the Boyne was the last when William III defeated the Stuarts for the last time, and James II in Ireland, and of course they went on and had all those battles in Scotland in the 18th century, but I mean, there are a lot of things that made them, I think, and certainly in their own eyes, super Christian.
This lady here.
I had a question about the Irish language and the percentage of the population that speaks it as native speakers, and the efforts by the government to revive the Irish language as a language generally spoken in Ireland.
Well, I think first of all, about everybody learns Irish at school, I would say about 40% of the population can carry on a conversation in Irish. About 25-30% are completely fluent. At the moment in Ireland, our Prime Minister is fluent in Irish, the Deputy Prime Minister is fluent, the Minister of Finance is fluent, the head of the major opposition party is fluent, the head of the Labour Party is fluent, the guy who was leader of the Green Party until recently is a fluent Irish speaker. So that's actually quite impressive. It has become like that. What's happened, I think, is that there probably is a declining population of people for whom it's the first language. More people are being brought up bilingual now, but in the 80s there was a huge movement to put kids in Irish immersion schools where they learned practically everything through Irish. So the result is, coming out of that, we've got a new generation of people who can speak Irish well. We have a very, very good Irish TV station, mm-hmm. Which has an awful lot of really wacky and bright stuff. It's really, really good. It's much better than the English TV stations we have. So it's not in any danger of dying. And it's a very peculiar example of cultural survival. And that's actually perhaps maybe the last thing to mention to people as we kind of break up, is that Ireland seems to preserve very, very strange cultural artifacts, be it the last bit of pure Indo-European stroke Celtic culture in Europe, you know, preserved orally for hundreds or thousands of years. Our so-called Irish music is to a large extent Scottish reels and English folk songs, which have died out in England, in particular the folk songs, and got preserved in Ireland. We also have our own music, but a lot of what passes for Irish music is you can trace it back to where it was first emerges in Scotland in the 18th century. So I think the last thing is, we tend to preserve very, very odd things. And one of the things that we're actually currently in the process of getting rid of is a very strange Victorian take on Roman Catholicism. And it will be interesting to see what replaces it.
All right. And in the interest of time, I think we have one more question in the back.
Actually, my question is, what do you see as the effect of the recent revelations about the church's tolerance of the child abuse? And has it eroded the legitimacy of the church?
I think the church is finished in Ireland. I think it's over. I think it's absolutely over. There's no way back from where it is right now. And I think the truth of the matter is it may have finished some time ago in perhaps less heated circumstances. Had not the Pope's visit to Ireland in 1979 been such a success, there was a kind of almost a way. You know, this religious fervor. The fact is, however, that an awful lot of people in Ireland knew this sex abuse was going on for a very long time, but just choose to notice it recently. But what we did not know until the last 10 years, we knew there was sex abuse going on, but we didn't know to what extent the church systematically allowed it. And you know, and that is what has just finished the Catholic Church. So I'm not joking when I say that this is the end of the particular era that we associate with Saint Patrick. You know, it's time to move on to something else. We have no idea yet what it is, but there's plenty of material there to work with in Irish history.
Great. All right. Well, thank you all for your insightful remarks and for the smashing performance.
Thank you.